God, please set aside everything we think we know about this meeting, tonight's speaker, the 12 steps, alcoholism, drug addiction, ourselves, you, and what we think this process is supposed to look like so we can have an open mind and a new experience. Help us see the truth. Amen.
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 As you listen to tonight's speaker, ask yourself the following questions. Did I ever think like that? Did I ever feel like that? Did I ever drink or use like that? Do I believe this program can work for me too? And so now I'm going to introduce our speaker for the evening. I met this man, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago. And, you know, sometimes we think we have to reinvent the wheel when it comes to excellence. But you don't have to. You find someone that has what you want, and then you do what they do. And you'll get a version of what they have. I didn't have a surrender under my belt when I first met him. I remember going to his big book study, thinking he was a prick. I'd go to this Friday night meeting where I could see that he was he was an elder in that group. And, you know, inside of, you know, I'm like, who do these people think they are? Because I still thought I was going to think my way out of my problem. And then I had my surrender. I got out of jail, and I was directed back to this Friday night meeting. But when I was in jail, I had the experience of being directed back specifically to him and this other guy, Randy, because at the time he was sponsoring Randy. And they, you know, they had tried to help me before. Randy had tried to work some steps with me. I'd gone to like a pool party at Dante's, a couple of events out at his house. And I wasn't in a position to receive what they were trying to give. And when I was in jail, I kept having these visions of going back to him and going back to Randy and going back specifically to the Monday night meeting that he had at his house. And there was nothing in me that was talking me out of it either, even the entire time I was incarcerated. And then I remember getting to the treatment center early in the week, and I was like, you guys got to get me to this Friday night meeting at Sandy Springs. I went back to that meeting. I got Randy as a sponsor, and I started going to this man's house every Monday night. And I stayed at that house every Monday night for 2 years. But there was something else that happened. He had what I wanted. And so unconsciously or consciously, I have no idea how it went down, but I started doing everything that he was doing. So I noticed that he got to the meeting early on Friday nights. He'd never walk in like as the meeting was starting. And so I'd start getting there early on Friday nights. And I think he would bring, which dog was it then? Was it Jackson?
Jackson.
Yeah, he would bring his dog. And I had a big Rottweiler, and we could be the first two at the meeting. Sometimes we'd set the meeting up, and I saw him doing service work, so I started emulating that. I started copying it. Next thing you know, I had some sponsees, so I was meeting the sponsees before, and then we would come set the meeting up, and Dante was always there. And then I noticed Dante always went out to Longhorn Steakhouse every Friday night. And I said, okay, so I'm going to start going to Longhorn Steakhouse every Friday night. And we did that for years. And I developed true fellowship. You know, this man has helped me not only in working steps and in several areas of my life. The longer I stay clean and sober, the less and less I like the word sponsor. He's been one of my sponsors, but he's always been one of my mentors and one of my greatest influences. The reason I know the big book as well as I do is because of this man. Because I sat there and he spoon-fed me the program of recovery out of the big book for 2 years. And so he had a certain way of selling this program that I've yet come across anybody that can sell it as well as him. And that's, remember, this big book was written by a salesman, right? And they say attraction rather than promotion, but we're giving a sales pitch. We're trying to make recovery attractive. There's no, you know, we are selling, okay? That's what we do. But we do it in a very attractive way. We don't try to, you know, shove it down your throat. And he had it for me. He got me hook, line, and sinker. And, you know, I'm very grateful to this man. That there was a lady sitting in my treatment center, Gail, And somehow she knew Dante. I remember sitting in therapy with her. She's like, you know, you really need to go to this guy's house. And I just followed that instruction. And I ended up there. And we went through the process. And I had the tools that I needed to help other people. And I saw by looking at him and watching him and how he lived his life that a lot of what was there in terms of what the culture and society says is success, it's just the surface stuff. There was something else there, and I knew it was connected to the amount of people he had helped. And when I tell you guys, I mean, we had this Friday night group, and people would come out of the woodworks. Somebody would show up at the meeting to pick up like an anniversary keychain or a medallion. And week after week, you'd have people like, yeah, I got clean at Dante's Big Book Workshop. I got clean at Dante's Big Book Workshop. I've yet in 10 and a half years stumbled across anyone personally that I know and have a relationship with that has carried the message to more people than this man. So I can sit up here and talk about Dante all night, but without further ado, I give you Dante.
Don't stop. I'm Dante. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. And, you know, the funny part about that is, you know, we all introduce ourselves in these meetings as alcoholics and addicts. And, you know, the first time I ever said those words, I didn't really have a problem with it. You know what I mean? It was, I didn't think about those words the way I do now. They didn't mean to me the same thing that they do now, but I didn't have a problem with it. You know, I kind of, sort of, from an early age on, kind of knew. You know, I had always had, you know, I'm one of these guys, I don't do anything half-assed, you know, right? Ever. You know, when we would play football, I was going to tackle the biggest guy. When we would play basketball, I was going to, you know, get the most rebounds. It didn't matter what we were doing, that's how I wanted to be. But what I wasn't expecting when I got here was that the simple fact that I am a drug addict and alcoholic, that would be the greatest asset that I personally have. If, you know, you pick somebody, whether it was Tarek or, you know, my wife, it doesn't matter. And they list out things about me. Somewhere at the top is going to be the simple fact that I'm a recovered alcoholic and recovered drug addict. You know, my first, you know, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, raised by a single mother. I have a younger brother and sister. I'm 55, he's 54, she's 54, he's 53. So that put us 1, 2, 3, all, you know, just like that through life. And, you know, I think I was 4 when my parents divorced. Didn't see my dad again until I was 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there, because my dad, you know, was Italian, had a temper, was violent when he drank. And he drank, all right, all the time. And so, my parents ended up divorced. My mother never said anything negative about my dad at all. Now, my dad would trash talk my mom, you know, that effing, you know, bitch, that, you know, white hoe, you know, just on and on. And he would say negative things about my mom, but my mom never responded in kind. And I noticed those things. But one of the things, influences that my mom did have is I had an aunt that was in college. One of her younger sisters, this was my very first experience with any kind of drugs or alcohol. So we're kids, I'm, you know, 8, 9, 10, somewhere in that realm of age. They're in the house, you know, the younger sister's in college. They're having a party. You know, they're drinking, smoking weed, the whole nine. And I've never seen it. I've seen people drink. But to me, it was no different watching somebody drink Coke. You know what I mean? It just wasn't a big deal. But I've not ever seen anybody smoke weed. So it bothered me. That was, you know, I was in the age in school where it was, you know, give a hoot, don't pollute, and, you know, only you can start a forest fire. And, I mean, you know, we weren't bombarded. There was just a few specific public announcements that they, you know, struck, and they, you know, stuck with you. So the whole thing about that really bothered me. And ran off in the woods, you know, and they had to send out a little searching party to find me, and they found me. I was crying. I was really upset. And my mom's like, look, the only thing wrong with marijuana is that it's illegal. All right? It doesn't physically harm you, doesn't this, doesn't that, all this stuff, but it is illegal, all right? So that was my first talk with one of my parents about drugs and alcohol, All right, she wasn't telling me to do it by any stretch of the imagination, but that was the explanation I got. And I don't know if that was her justifying what they were doing or if that's how she felt. You know, we haven't really ever talked about that part. She's been to my story a few times and heard me tell that and always gets pissed off, but that's another story. So that was it. So many years later, you know, I think my aunt had come home 2 years, so I'm, you know, 10, 11, 12, I'm somewhere in that age. And everybody's downstairs doing something, and I'm upstairs piddling around, and I'm, you know, looking for change, going, you know, snatch 50 cents or whatever, and I come across a bag of weed. And I knew instantly what it was, all right, because I remember seeing it, and I started thinking, you know, I'll give this a shot. So I go in the bathroom, and, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. So I rip off a couple of squares of toilet paper. I roll me up a big old fat fucked up joint, and I light it, and it just... poof, it's gone. So that was my first time I didn't get high, obviously. I'm not sure if you call that smoking pot, but I was definitely trying, all right? My real first experience with anything was at a boarding school in Searcy, Arkansas. It was, you know, my mom, because my dad wasn't in my life, thought me and my brother needed to have male influences because it was my mother, my grandmother, that's where we lived. You know, a couple of aunts, sisters, so me and my brother were outnumbered, and she thought we needed a male influence other than my dad, so her answer to that is to send us off to a place in Searcy, Arkansas, run by Franciscan monks. And everybody thought, in a way, we were like being punished, but honestly, I did better than I'd ever done in my life there. The male influence on me was good, all right? But being around that many kids from that many parts of the country, you know, who had older brothers and sisters and who had experimented with stuff, you know, led me right down that road. You know, I think, you know, I was there in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. In the 6th grade, it was smoking cigarettes. In the 7th grade, it was drinking. And by the time I got to the 8th grade, it was smoking weed on a regular basis, and that was there. So I get asked not to come back because we were on scholarship. I end up at another school, boarding school, Suwannee Academy. It's on top of Mount Eagle Mountain. There's a university up there called Suwannee, and they have a high school. So the 9th grade, I mean, I was exposed to people of different incomes who were into all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, it was, you know, I think there was 400 people that started at that school my freshman year, and I got kicked out on my birthday, which is February 26th, and I think that when I got kicked out, it was almost two-thirds of the school, and it was all drug-related. So, you know, I'm not sure if I wouldn't classify myself then as being a drug addict or an alcoholic. I was having fun, you know what I mean? I mean, you know, everything I did, you know, it's kind of like in the book when Bill talks about, you know, I had arrived and, you know, in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. That's the way it was for me. It wasn't any different. There wasn't a void I was trying to fill up. That's just me personally. I had no void. Didn't have resentments against my mom. I wasn't pissed I was sent to a boarding school. I actually had a blast. All right. But when I left there and ended up back in Nashville, 11th grade, the drugs became more serious. You know, we started experimenting with pills. You know, we would break in a pharmacy, all right, take just scoop in trash bags. And then we'd go home with our PDR book, figure out what the good ones were, what the bad ones were. And then we would have party after party after party after party. You know, that made it really easy to move into stuff like cocaine. And I remember I was with a girlfriend. We were in Florida. And, you know, we're with a guy, and he says, hey, if y'all don't mind, I'm going to shoot mine. I'm like, you know, dude, whatever. You know, go for it. I don't care. Just lay me out a little line. Well, my girlfriend, she made some comment to the effect of, oh, come on, it's not a big deal. And I remember thinking, you know, I was thinking of this on the way down here, actually. What she didn't realize that she had done at that time was she had just introduced me to my new girlfriend. All right? Because after that, it wasn't her no more, all right? There never was anybody else who entered my life that was important as that was then. And it was so good and went so well that I got my brother on it, all right? That way I'd have, you know, everybody's got an Ebby. You know, when you read Bill and he talks about Ebby coming back into his life, you know, Ebby was the guy who no matter how bad it got for Bill, he could always say, Ebby's worse. Well, no matter how bad shit got for me, my entire life I could point to my brother and say, he's worse. If I got in trouble, he'd get in more trouble. If I get kicked out of, you know, four schools, five schools. If I'd get locked up for a month, 2 months. You know, if I would, you know, if I had a DUI, 8 DUIs. I mean, that's the way it was my whole life. So when the negative attention would get focused on me, it was really easy to get it off, especially to the people that mattered to me. You know, my mom, my sister, my, you know, grandparents, stuff like that. It was always easy to get the negative attention off me and on the rig until my junior year in high school. My mom goes to New York to, it's a long story, but they're going to write a book about her. This is when I'm in high school. She goes to New York to work with this author. I'm supposed to be at my dad's house because he had entered back in my life. My dad was my using buddy. Right? I wasn't shooting dope with my dad, but we would snort cocaine and we would drink. We would, you know, smoke weed and have fun and hang out all night and party and all that. So she stays in New York. I'm at his house. I give her time to get from Atlanta, dropping me off back to New York driving. And then I left and went back to Nashville. And I had it worked out with my friends. It was a little bit different in them days. You only had a phone that had a wire attached to something, right? And then we had a cell phone. Nobody had a pager. Nobody had anything like that. So the way it went was that if anybody called, they would call, ring 3 times, hang up, and then call back, and we would answer. And that's how I knew it was my friend and not somebody checking on me. So I stayed in Atlanta all summer long, started my seat, got in all kind of trouble, sitting at, started my senior year of high school at my girlfriend's house. She'd moved out, living with some other girls. I stayed over there all the time, and there's a knock on the door. And I, you know, her window was right by the door, so I cracked the blinds and looked, and it's two, they're, you know, plain clothes, but it was obvious this is two police officers. She's like, you know, who is that? And I'm like, it's two cops. She's like, how do you know? I said, I just know. She goes, what are they here for? I said, it ain't going to be good. So I was arrested that day, and the charges that they arrested me for was, you know, it was in, I don't remember the exact number, but it was in the teens of breaking and entering. It was in the teens of grand larceny. It was in the teens of, you know, just all, anything that had to do with stealing. It was, you know, not over 20, but wasn't under 12, let's put it that way. So I was in, obviously, a world of shit. So when we're leaving, they put me in the back of the car. We're leaving, they're going to take me to the police. I'm 17, so technically I'm a minor. You know, my mom had been involved in politics in Tennessee, so everybody knew who what my last name was associated with, all right? So I asked, could he go by my house so that I could talk to my mom? And when we get there, my mom's brother happened to be there, and his name is Chris. He's now been sober. I want to say, I think he told me, that I talked to him about a week and a half ago. He's been sober 51 years, all right? So at that time, it was in the, like, 20s, because this is, you know, I'm 17, I'm 55, do the math, because I'd need a calculator. But. So he asked, could he ride with me? And they said, yeah. All the way down there, all he did was tell me, there's one or two things you can do here. You can lie your ass off, or you can tell the truth. I'm not saying either way is going to prevent you from getting into trouble, but if you tell the truth, it's going to be easier to deal with on down the road. So I thought, you know, I'm thinking about all this stuff. I'm thinking I'm lying. I'm going to lie. I'm going to lie. I'm going to lie. I'm gonna, you know, whatever they think they get, I'll admit to. But if they ain't sure, I ain't telling them, all that kind of stuff. So we spend all day down there, and then all the charges pile up. And there was definitely that many things they knew, and there was a whole bunch of other shit they didn't. And so I'm in serious trouble. All right, I go to my first court date because the court was real quick. You know, I'm supposed to be a senior in high school. I actually quit, but I tell, well, let's tell you when I quit. So I go to my first court date, and the next day I go to school. Now, I'm a senior in high school, and I walk into my English teacher, and I was like 5 minutes late or something, so I'm trying to slink around, sitting in the back, and, you know, for some reason I'm thinking, you know, like we all think, don't nobody know nothing about what's going on with me in my life. This is, you know, whatever. I'm here at school. And my English teacher goes, well, what I didn't know was that I'd been on the front page of the newspaper that day. And, now, I'm a minor, and they're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to put your face on the paper. They're not allowed to use your name. But they had decided, because of the animosity they had toward my mom, that they were willing to risk a lawsuit, or they were willing to risk getting in trouble. So he stands up and says, you know, does anybody have anything interesting going on in their life today? You know, and I'm just sitting in the back. I'm not paying any attention. You know, and he holds up the paper and he says, Dante, would you like to share? And I'll never forget that feeling. I felt so fucking small. I mean, I felt like this big. And it was all I could do to not cry. It was all I mean, I wasn't going to say anything because I knew if I opened my mouth, I was going to lose it. So I got up. That was my last day of school. I left. I quit high school. Me and my girlfriend moved to Atlanta. That was how I ended up here. This is where my dad lived. And proceeded to, you know, do everything I was doing, only now I was in Atlanta and I would make trips back to go to court. Well, the first part of court was them trying to decide on whether or not they were going to try me. The courts wanted to try me as an adult, all right? My lawyer wanted me, obviously, to be tried as a juvenile because the differences in where you end up and the time periods associated with that are really different and really serious. So I think all my stuff together was going to be 45 years if I'd have been tried as an adult. So this drags on until I was 21, and two, three days before my 21st birthday, the judge decides that I'm going to be tried as a juvenile, and then, therefore, as soon as he hit the gavel, all my troubles were over with as far as legally went, because I'm now 21, so none of that applies, so I completely scathed it. Which was good news in one way, because I don't know what would have happened had I gone to prison for 45 years. I'm guessing I may or may not be sitting here talking to y'all right now. All right. But the other thing that happened was I thought, damn, so, you know, no matter how bad it is, there's a way to get out of it. All right. So 21, that ends. 22, you know, it's literally, you know, I would, my brother worked with me. I worked for, you know, I pour concrete, set the aluminum forms, fill them up with concrete, basements for houses, big walls, all that stuff. I've done it my entire life. My brother worked with me, and so we'd stay up all night shooting dope and then get up and go to work. Well, there wasn't no getting up. We would peek, and when the sun came up, we'd go out front, and somebody would pull up, pick us up, and we'd go work all day, and then we'd come home, we'd do dope all night. That was just how it went. And I can remember one night, him, you know, it would be, you know, after a while you kind of get a little shaky, so you have to do each other. You can't do yourself no more. So I give him a big old shot, and he falls out, and he's laying on the floor, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at him, and he's this pasty, white mixed with yellow color. He just looked fucked up, all right? And except that I could kind of see his pulse beating, in his neck, because his head was all fucked up, laid over, was the only thing I knew he wasn't dying. I remember thinking, he's going to die. And I remember it scared the living shit. I thought, man, my brother is going to die. And I remember, you know, Rick, get up, Rick. But, you know, after about 5 or 10 minutes, he's like, what? And I'm like, you all right? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, all right, here, do me. And that's how I think we all are. You know what I mean? We come this close, like, and then it'd be me on the ground and him waking me up, and the same thing would happen, and it would be just, you know, that would be our nights. And this went on for a long time. Somewhere in there, I meet a girl who's now my wife, so it ends well. But, you know, she moves in with me, and I'm still doing all these things, only I'm hiding it real well. You know, I'd work in the, you know, it'd be 105 in August, I'd be working in a long sleeve shirt just to cover up my arms. We would never go hanging, didn't have any interest in the lake, nothing like that in them days. And every now and then she would find something. Like one night she's cleaning out the bathroom, and she's like, you know, what is this? And it was a little baggie of syringes, and I'm like, fuck, that's so-and-so, you know, I'm hiding them for him. So that was how I would play all that stuff off. Well, you know, that works for a little while. You can fool, you know, some of the people some of the time, but you ain't fooling them all the time. So sooner or later she catches on, and, you know, I'm going to leave if you don't stop, blah, 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 blah. So now I'm not saying, and the reason I'm clarifying this is because my daughter's here. I'm not saying that the reason I asked her to marry me was to take the attention off of me, but I knew it wasn't going to hurt. You know what I mean? I did love this girl. I've been married almost 30 years, so the proof's in the pudding. But I thought, you know, let's get married. And instantly it went from, you need to quit doing this, to you now need to pay for this. All right? And because, you know, I didn't come for money. My mama wasn't going to pay for nothing. Her parents weren't going to pay for anything. And so I would work. Sun up to sundown, do dope all night, sun up to sundown. And every time she'd say, you know, here's a bill for this, I'd give her a stack of 100. You know, so we paid for our wedding, had a big time, went on a honeymoon, had a big time, you know, drinking, didn't do drugs down there, but drank the whole time and all that. Come home, and literally, we got married in June, all right, the end of June. By the middle of August, she had packed and left, all right, and that was it. I fucked up. You're, you know, scumbag, drug addict, all that stuff. You know, everybody in her family, you know, the advice she was getting was you need to leave him now. You know, it's not worth staying around for what's certainly going to be trials and tribulations. And, in my heart, that wasn't what I wanted. So I said, look, what's it going to take? She said, it's going to take you getting sober, and it's going to take us going to marriage counseling. So, you know, I'm always slick and got an answer for a whole lot of stuff. So I decide we'll go see a marriage counselor. Going to have to be free because, you know, I'm broke by this time. So we start going and seeing my granddad, who at this time is like, you know, 65. I'm 25. He's like 65, 70. And I'm thinking, you know, this will be okay because he did that kind of stuff. And so what we would do is I would drive from, I lived at Northridge and 400. I would drive to Buford, pick up my wife. We would go to Athens, see my granddad. And my granddad, on the first day, he told me that he had one condition. What's that condition? He said, you have to go to an AA meeting. I said, all right, I can do that. So what I would do was on Friday night, I'd go to 8111, go pick her up on Saturday, go see him on Saturday afternoon. He would say, did you go to a meeting? I'd say, yeah. He would never ask me, was I sober? He just told me to go to a meeting, so I was going. And that went on for a little bit. And then somewhere in there, my brother goes to treatment. And he's at this place called First Step out on Bells Ferry Road. I don't think it's there anymore. I hadn't been there in a long time. So I would go, and me and my brother would sit in the back during the AA. You know, they'd have AA. There'd be some kind of meeting there every night. Monday through Thursday, it was AA. Friday was NA. Saturday was a CA meeting. And Sunday was AA again. We'd sit in the back. And he would go, you know, that guy's a dickhead, and, you know, I was banging her last night, and, you know, and he'd point shit, and we'd laugh and cut up, and that'd be, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Friday was a little bit different. You know, the guy at the NA meeting kind of, you know, hit a couple of nerves in there. But Saturday night, my first Cocaine Anonymous meeting in my life, I'm sitting there, and that was just something different. All right, it wasn't that they read the steps different. You know, it wasn't that they didn't do how they did how it works different. They didn't read all the same shit they do at all the same meetings, but it was the guys. And for some reason, there was three or four of them in there I could relate to. So I kind of perked up, and I talked to them after the meeting. They said, well, this is where we go on Tuesday. This is where we go on Friday. This is where we go on, you know, they told me their little schedule, and I started meeting them. And so I'm meeting them, and the whole time I'm meeting them at all these meetings, I'm sober. I'm starting to stay sober. Okay, this is October, so my sobriety date is tied to that CA meeting, all right? And my sobriety date is October 10th, 1988, all right? I was 25 or 8 years old. Hell, I don't remember now, but it's a long time ago. but there was just something about CA, so I started putting together time. You know, there goes 30 days, there goes 60. There's not, you know, I had my birthday. My uncle came down, told the story. It was great. Rick was, you know, my brother was fucked up in Marriott Marquis hotel lobby. So me and my sponsor, after my 1 year birthday, went and picked him up to take him somewhere. And things were okay. All right. Now, I'm telling you about my time because that's really all I had. You know, what we did is CA was really young in those days. All right. I think when I came in 88, I think CA, Cocaine Anonymous, might have started in 82. 81, 82, 83. So in our meetings, if somebody had 4 years in CA, that was a big fucking, they were like the guru, all right? So there was that guy in our meeting. He was, you know, I liked him a lot. And, but after my 1 year went by, and I had like 13 months, 14 months, you know, when I love him to death, he, you know, was the right person for me at the right time. But my sponsor started having marital issues, and so I would spend on a meeting. He would ride around. He thought his wife was fucking around, and so I'll never forget this. I'm standing outside a meeting in the pouring down rain in the bushes like this, looking in the glass to see if his wife's in this meeting with some guy. And I remember thinking, clear as a bell, if this is what it's like, something's wrong. If I'm him, I'm not having somebody up here doing this. I'm either in there killing somebody or I'm definitely doing dope again. And it scared the shit out of me because, you know, I kind of had some good friends and I enjoyed what I was doing. I wasn't missing and thinking about coke. I definitely hadn't had a spiritual awakening. I'd not had a spiritual, you know, experience, but the fellowship was working for me at that time. All right. So I end up, for about a month, I'd been dragging this kid around who didn't have a driver's license because my sponsor, for a long time in sobriety, I didn't have a license, and somebody would always come and pick me up and take me anywhere I needed to go. During the day, it was my brother for work, and at night, somebody always would come get me and take me to a meeting. It was just a given. So he told me, your job is to take that kid around because he doesn't have a license because we toted you around. I'm like, all right, I can do that. Well, number one, I couldn't stand this guy. All right. Number two, all he talked about was this other group of guys and what they did. And what he described to me, it sounded like a cult. So in the beginning, I wasn't interested. But I'm sitting there that night in the rain, and I thought, you know, maybe I need to check out what he's doing because what I'm doing ain't working. All right? And I'm thinking of Scott. That was his name. So he says, this is where they meet. Went up to 8111. They had a little room they'd meet in, a small room, because the other room was the big meeting and had all the, you know, cool people in it. And they did a book study. And my first night, they were getting ready to start step four. They went over step three. And the way he explained step three and the way they went into step four was something different I'd never heard. So I'm getting them now, but that night, listening to them describe all this, it just started clicking. This is somebody that knows what's going on. This is not like anything I'd experienced before. I've got to get some of this. So when the meeting was over, they did this thing where there was a guy that sat up here, Joe. He would make all the little smart-ass comments, but there was a guy in the back who was throwing the ball, you know, the little lobs up. And then Joe would smack him. You know, he'd say something smart-ass and then, you know, set Joe up, and he'd, you know, cram it down their throats. And I thought, you know, I don't really want him. I want that guy in the back. Well, it turned out his name was Pat. He was younger than me. He was, I want to say, 6 months fewer than me on sobriety. I was, you know, he wasn't even a year sober. But he had it going on, I could tell. So I go up to him after the meeting. I'm like, look, you know, I've gone through all the steps. Me and my guys, this is what we did, da da da. But I think I need to do the four step over. Will you show me that? And he said, that's not how it works. The way it works is we'll sit you down and we'll do kind of what we were doing in that meeting, but one on one. When can you start? Fuck, I'll start tonight. So we go to his house. I'm there till about 2 in the morning. We went all the way up through the doctor's opinion the first time we got together. I get home. It's real late. My wife's like, where the fuck have you been? I'm like, you're never going to believe it. I found these guys. They know what's going on. I mean, I'm on fire. I am literally on fucking fire. She thinks I'm relapsed. I go to bed. I get up and go to work. When Pat gets off work, comes walking up. He lived in the same apartment complex. He was the maintenance guy. So when he come walking up those steps to his apartment after work, I'd be sitting on the top step. And that was every single day. After the third day, my wife said, I tell you what, since this is all so great, surely they won't mind coming over here for a night. I said, I'll ask them. So we started meeting in my house. And it was really kind of weird because my son's 28 now. My wife was pregnant then, all right? Literally 9 months with my first child. Small apartment. Kitchen had a little cutout where you could look into the living room, and so she'd spend her time in the bedroom. We'd sit up and do our book study, but she'd always come waddling down the hall and in the kitchen, and she'd be in there piddling around. But what I couldn't tell because I couldn't see her, but Joe and Pat could see her. She was in there listening. She was like, you know, this shit. And so she was coming out, like, you know, the third trip that night. And Joe says, hey, why don't you join us? She's like, I'm not an alcoholic. He goes, well, I didn't say you were an alcoholic, but, you know, you want to see what it is we do? Pull up a chair. We got another bud. So she did. And the funny thing about all this, or that, was when I got finished with my four step, all right, which was literally coming up into a week, and did a fifth step. When I got finished with my fifth step, she did a fifth step with my sponsor. Because she went through the stuff at the same time I did. She was just a little bit behind me, but as I was going through the first time, she was going through, you know, behind me. And, you know, it just everything about it, you know, that was 19, 90, 89. That was 1989, 90, somewhere in there. And literally since then, and some of what Tarek is describing describes it really well, I don't know that the flame's ever gone out. I don't know that it's ever been anything less than a bonfire. All right, and that, and I feel it. Something, you know, in the beginning it was only words on a page that turned me on. You know what I mean? But they did mean something. As I went through the steps, the things they described happened, you know, after I did my fifth step. Well, during my fourth step, I kind of paused in there for about a week and got laid off of work. My wife's still pregnant. My truck had been repossessed. You know, I was, you know, not going to be able to make my rent. You know, I got, in my mind, the world is crushing down. And so I called up Joe. Couldn't get Pat, so I ended up calling up Joe. Joe's like, you know, he starts laughing. I'm like, dude, you didn't hear what I said. You know, my wife's late. I don't have insurance. I'm going to get stuck with all these bills. My truck got repoed. I got fired from my fucking job today. You know, I'm not going to be able to make my rent. You know, I mean, everything in the world that's important to us or important to me was going on, was going negative. And he said, yeah, but you've been bitching, moaning, and complaining that you ain't had time to do your four step, and now you do. What are you going to do? You know, God either is or he isn't. What's your choice going to be? And I was at them crossroads. And the most important decision I ever made in my life was God is. And so I started going down to Sandy Springs Library, and the next 2 days I finished my four step and then rocked right through my fifth step. And the following Saturday, I'm laying there in bed. I'm thinking, all I can think about is the program. All I can think about is God. All I can think about is all this good shit that's been happening to me. You know, 2 weeks ago, I'm like ready to shoot myself because my world had ended. But, you know, that's the thing, beauty about all this is there ain't no time limits on it. You know, if you're having a shitty day, that can change in an hour. You know, it doesn't have to drag on. I was used to everything dragging on. You know, I was used to, I'd string the drama out. You know, in the program, you don't have to, it can be instant. It's just as quick as you do it. So I'm sitting there, or laying there, and I'm thinking all these things, and then all of a sudden it hit me. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? You know, I've been laying here for fucking 30 minutes, and I hadn't been thinking about anything but God and the program and the steps and book and, you know, all this stuff. And I realized, fuck, them guys tricked me, all right? Because I don't know anybody. This is me personally, and I'm almost 30 years, so I'm 29 and a half years sober. And in the 29 and a half years I've been here, I have yet to meet anybody who has walked into this meeting for the first time looking for God. That ain't what we come here for. We want our cars back. We want our families back. We want our house back. We want our stuff back. Nowhere in there does somebody come in here and say, hey, y'all know where I can find God? You know, I got all these issues, and I know that's the answer. Is this the place? That ain't what we come here for. It's a million different reasons, but that ain't one of them. You know, some of the things that I like, you know, that have, you know, the 12th step, you know, I remember, you know, like Tarek was saying, I've done a ton of book studies, and I don't know how many people I've worked with. You know, one time I tried to count them up, and I got fucking, you know, sidetracked and started thinking about basketball or something. That's how my mind works. But it's been a lot of people, all right, and it's been for a long time. I mean, I bought into it early, and I ain't never done anything different since then. Doesn't mean I'm perfect. I have my problems. I have my issues. My wife will tell you, you know, there's times I'm a dickhead, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But the reality is that there's really not drama in my life unless I want there to be. All right. Anytime somebody says something to me, where that relationship, the next step is always up to me. If they're saying something to me positive, I can keep it positive. If they're saying something negative, I can keep it negative. But it's always up to me. Period in the story on where that relationship goes. No different than the relationship I have with God. Where my relationship with God goes is 100% dependent upon me. You know, he's always been there. You know, they tell you all these things in the book that are really true. You know, we find God deep down within. You know, that's where I found God. I found him on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday morning laying in my bed by accident. You know, I just realized, fuck, you know, I was tricked. You know, and that's because it's what Tarek was saying earlier. It is a sales pitch. I had a good salesman in my life. It just so happened that when we got up to the point where they started talking about God, it really wasn't that I wasn't this guy that had problems with God. I was raised a Catholic. I went to a school run by monks. I mean, you know, I've had nuns smack my hand and, you know, swats in the fucking gym and the whole nine. So I didn't have all, you know, I was raised around it. My mother's a devout Catholic. Everything good that's ever happened in her life is a direct result of her relationship with God and has been since I was young. Everything negative that's happened to her in her life, she's made it through because of her relationship with God, and it's been that way my entire life. So it wasn't like I didn't see God and didn't know God and didn't know that God was doing good stuff in people's life, because I did. But I was having too much fun to get into that shit, you know what I mean, until it was too late. You know, like everybody, you know, I had crossed the line not knowing it. You know, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or a drug addict, but it really doesn't matter. You know, when I got to the point where I'm over here, I could have quit if I'd have wanted to, but I didn't want to. When I got over there and I wanted to quit, I couldn't. So wherever the line was, no, none of us know, and that's the problem. You know, nobody knows when they cross it. I have some, you know, ideas, but none of it really matters. You know, we talk about the 12th step, and we explain it as really it's a promise. Haven't had, which is past tense, all right, personal relationship with God because of the steps we've done, but it's also a statement of fact, all right? When you get there, it is a fact. That will have happened, period, in the story. What you get as a result of it is the promise, but the fact that you got there and that it happened is a statement of fact. And it's a fact in my life today that the most important relationship I have is with God. I start my mornings out exactly the same every day, no matter where I am. All right, and if I'm not able to do it immediately in the morning, I always get away where I can. You know, my conversation with God starts every morning and lasts as long as I want it to. You know, moments of indecision. I didn't get a relationship by the pages 84 and 85, 86, 87 of, you know, when they talk about the 11th step. You know, I didn't know how to pray, so I made me a copy, folded it up, put it in my wallet. In the morning, I'd get up and read it. During the day, this is how you start. Oh, okay. You know, moments of indecision, this is what you do. Oh, okay, excuse me, I got to go to the bathroom, and I'd be in there, you know, what the fuck do I do now, and all that. But over time, it turns into a relationship with God, all right? I'm not sure when it went from me transferring knowledge that I had about that book to there's nothing that I cover in those first 164 pages that I haven't experienced multiple times personally. And I don't know where that was time-wise, but I know that the first time I thought about it, I thought, damn, oh, that's just me. And at first I kind of thought, you know, maybe I was getting big-headed about it. And then I realized, no, you know, when they talk about an intuitive thought, well, when you get to the point where you're doing something and you intuitively know what to do and it's the right thing, that ain't happening up here no more. That's happening in here. All right. So the stuff that I've learned in that book, and in the beginning, it's obviously it's just us learning. It's no different than, you know, getting a math book. You know, you don't go to chapter 5 and start trying to learn algebra. You start in the beginning. You know, I don't know where everybody is in this. I mean, there's definitely some faces I know and definitely some names I know, but the reality is I know everybody in this room, all right? And the reason I'm able to say I know everybody in this room is because whatever you've done, I've been there and done that, no matter what it is. No matter, you know, that little bitty dark, you know, that goat in Montana, dude, you know, been there and done that, all right? You ain't no worse than, you know, none of us are any worse than any other ones, all right? That's the, you know, the common problem, the common solution. She knows, she's heard about the goat. Don't worry about it. She was thinking, what about the pig? But that's another story. It definitely has moved from what I know to it's just a part of my life. It is a design for living. It's my design for living. It can be yours too, all right? But right now it's mine, all right? It is a way of life. It's my way of life, all right? It doesn't mean that I'm perfect. Doesn't mean that I don't make mistakes, but when I do, I know what to do about it. I don't have to, you know, it used to be that I would do something, I'd be like, God, I got to get that on paper, and, you know, what this column, that column, you know, where was I? Okay, I was this, I was that, and then I'd call somebody up, and I'd be like, look, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then they'd be like, okay, you need to da-da-da-da-da, and then I'd go do it. Now it doesn't work that way. You know, now, I mean, while it's happening, I know I'm wrong. While I'm happening, I know what part was affected. You know what I mean? And before you get out the door, I'd like to have it resolved. All right? And that's different than, I mean, it is intuition. You know what I mean? And that's the part, you know, I think everybody, you know, goes through, I don't know if burnout's the right word, but you know, everybody kind of hits that lull. All right. Well, I learned a long time. You know, when I was telling you about the original gang in CA. All right. I'm the only one left. And all my guys, ain't none of them around. All right. Now they all got in the book because I picked them off one by one and took them through the book. They all were doing good. We were all doing good. It was a fucking awesome thing to be a part of. But the difference, and I honestly believe this in my heart, the difference on why I'm here and why they ain't is because somewhere along the line, the working with others stopped. Because God's going to do for me what I can't do for myself. But that means, really, that there's an awful lot of stuff I can do. I've never said no, ever. Now, I may have said, look, I really don't have the time, so I'm going to hook you up with this guy. Come on, I'll find you a guy. You know, come on, I'll find you a girl. You know, I'll do that if I don't have the time. But, I mean, I had a guy at my house today. I think 70 days. You know what I mean? So I don't focus on, you know, what was I like. Like, you know, it's really weird because I was thinking on the way down here. First time I really put any thought into doing this tonight was on the way down here. But that's okay. I stay in touch with how I was because of the new guys that I work with. You know what I mean? I don't vividly remember it. You know what I mean? I know the experiences. I know what it took to get me into this room. You know what I mean? I mean, I know those are facts of me, of shit I did, period, in the story. But I've been so far removed from the obsession. I haven't thought about, you know, me thinking about drinking isn't me thinking about drinking. It's me thinking about what can I do to keep you from drinking. All right, because I don't think about it. You know what I mean? Not at all. I don't have the occasional thought that they talked about in the book. That hadn't happened in a long time. All right? But I know why. I know exactly why. It's because I work with people. You know, and it tells you. You know, the stuff in the book is so true. You know, nothing ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work, one alcoholic with another. Intensive. You know what I mean? That's like with great effort. All right? That's trying. That's giving a shit. And I do. Because as good as all the things are that have happened to me, when I get to experience somebody else happening the first time, man, that's better than the way it was when I went through it. And that's the stuff that means something to me. You know, when they talk about being selfless, I mean, dude, you know, I can be every bit as selfish as the next guy. You know what I mean? But like I said before, while it's happening, I'm aware of it. I know what I need to do to correct it. If they leave the room, or whatever situation I'm in, if the other party leaves, if somebody else is gone and there's still something wrong with that relationship, it's never on them. It's always on me. Because while they're turning the corner, I know what I need to be doing. It's just, am I going to do it or not? Am I going to do it today? Am I going to do it tomorrow? Am I going to sit in this shit for a little bit or am I not? You know, it's entirely up to me. You know, the things, you know, I don't know, you know, when I look at, you know, in... I tell you some of the other good stuff is the other two, what's today, Wednesday? So a week ago from yesterday, I gave one of my sponsees his 23-year chip. I'm, motherfucker, you know how that made me feel? Well, first it made me feel really old, all right? But after that, I thought, shit, I was thinking about it. While I'm saying these things, fixing and handing me his chip, I'm thinking, I remember when this motherfucker wasn't married. Now he's got his youngest kids graduating from high school. You know, and I've seen all these good things happen to this guy. This one here, too. You know, I've seen it. You know, I remember Tarek showing up. Hey, I've got this idea. All right? But y'all are sitting in this idea. All right? But I remember meeting him when he had it. And then it was, he had it on paper. And then he had it, and he had it on paper, and I need to find a place and start figuring out how to get number one, because there's always somebody's got to be number one. All right, and I think today there's 14. I don't know how many people have come through here, you know, but the success rate is really high, and there's a reason, and that's because the method is really good. All right, the, you know, Tarek's never strayed, you know, probably in my humble opinion. I think I have passion. All right, I think the flame still burns. There's no question. But I think Tarek has passion, and the flame still burns within him too. All right, and when I meet guys and they've got that spark, you know, my job is to put gas on it. All right, and in this case, the gas is God. And it really doesn't get any better than that. You know, I'm sitting here with a guy today. You know, I think yesterday was 70 days. We're sitting in my house. You know, he's on his fourth step. He's got all this shit going on in his life, man. And, I mean, he's got some shit going on in his life. And I was thinking, I remember exactly how he feels right now. He don't know up from down, left from right, but he wants something different. You know, he wants to change. You know, in the beginning, you got to... You know, some people come in here and they're at the, they want to quit. You got to go from the want to quit to wanting to quit. All right. Once you go to from 49 to 50 to 51, you're going to be okay. That's the desire. It doesn't take 100% desire. You just got to go from 49 to 51, and that's enough. That's the spark. You know, in the all the stuff you're doing on y'all's daily routine. I don't know your daily routine as well as y'all, because you're doing it, or Tarek because he's written it, but I know what you're doing. You know what I mean? I know that you're working on a solution for the problem you had when you came in here. I know that when you came in here, wasn't nobody in this room looking for God, but that's what you're going to get. And I know that if you get it and you hold on to it and you do the thing, you know, they 10, 11, and 12, you know, people call them maintenance steps. Man, I'm going to tell you right now, that's the biggest crock of bullshit that anybody's ever said in one of these rooms, because there ain't nothing to maintain. If you maintain, you know, an unchanged man will drink again. All right? So you've always got to be changing. You're either growing or you're dying. You know, you're either moving forwards or you're moving backwards. Period in the story. There's no sitting still. Sitting still is going to be, oh, this ain't bad. I kind of like this. Yeah, I can drink again. I know what I'm doing now. That's what sitting still does to you, which to me is the same thing as moving back. All right? So, I don't know what else to say. I could actually talk on nothing but the good stuff for another hour, because I happen to believe every word of it. All right? I happen to have experienced every word of it. You know, and I'm telling you, every fucking one of you, you can experience the same thing. You know, 29 and a half years, all that is a 24-hour day plus a 24-hour day plus a 24-hour day plus a 20 for a whole much longer bunch of them. You know what I mean? You do that enough times and it turns into 29 years. And somewhere through that process, it goes from I know the book to I live the book. All right? And that's really ultimately what it's all about. All right? I can't say enough about, you know, the stuff y'all are in. You know, the launching pad itself. You know, I got, you know, real strong emotional attachment to the launching pad. I have very strong opinions about the launching pad. I don't think there's another place like this place in this fucking country. And I've looked all over this country looking for places. All right? So as far as, you know, are you sitting in the right chair tonight? I absolutely 100% in my heart and in my brain know that answer is yeah. You might not know that yet, all right? But my hope for you is that you figure that out, all right? So with that, thanks for letting me share.
I've asked Cody to read the 10-step promises.
My name is Cody. I'm an alcoholic and addict. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol and drugs, for by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor or drugs. If tempted, we recoil from it as a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we'll find that this happened automatically. We see that our new attitude towards all mind-altering substances has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, nor are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cody. Let's circle up, and Hannah, will you take us out in the serenity prayer?
Thanks for letting me bring the only female member that's attended to one of these, all right?
I appreciate it.
Like, really, what do you... I don't.
The serenity prayer.
Just say the three-letter word.
Oh. God.
Prayer is the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Dude, I don't know what's going on.